funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the leadership of General David Petraeus shape the course of the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and how did his long and storied military career prepare him for his new assignment as director of the CIA? My guest today has studied Petraeus' life and career from his childhood with a loving but stern and demanding father, through his days at West Point at the end of the Vietnam era, through his Army assignments in the U.S., Europe, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Paula Broadwell is Research Associate at the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard and author of the new book All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. She's in town for World Affairs Council events in Dallas and Fort Worth tonight and tomorrow. You can find information and buy tickets at dfwworld.org. Paula, welcome to THINK.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm fascinated by the story of how you and now Director Petraeus met because it's indicative of his really abiding faith in the value of mentorship.
That's right. Well, I had approached him when he was visiting Harvard, and he had come to speak about the counterinsurgency field manual. He was at Fort Leavenworth at the time writing this manual, and he came to Harvard, and he was traveling around visiting other universities. But he wanted to sort of spread the word about this new doctrine that he was trying to infuse into the military so we could win the wars we were fighting. And I was invited with a group of other veteran students to have a dinner with him after his presentation. And I went up to him and said, I'm writing this paper on negotiating with terrorists, and I'd love to connect with your people and share it with you. And he said, here's my card. Let's stay in touch, which he does all the time. And I think it's one of his most effective leadership techniques, reaching out to anyone who has a good idea or having an open door policy, if you will. And that's where our sort of email academic relationship started. Even though I have a military background, I sort of knew him through academic channels.
Mm-hmm. So as a leader, he wants a lot of information before he makes a major decision. How tolerant is he of dissenting opinions?
I think he actually invites dissenting opinions. He is known for his formation of what are called red teams mm-hmm. in the Army and the military. And basically, those are a team that play devil's advocate. They have most of the information that the friendly forces have, but then they try to think like the enemy. And they'll challenge him, you know, whether it's with the strategy in Afghanistan or while he was at CENTCOM, he had red teams as well, looking across the entire theater of 20 different countries that all seem to have crises at the same time. He invites outsiders from think tanks, from the press, to come into the tent, if you will. And if you look at what he was doing while he was writing this counterinsurgency field manual, He took an atypical approach, and he invited human rights activists, and he invited the press, and he invited those who were real skeptics of counterinsurgency to come inside the tent and join in the dialogue to formulate this new doctrine that he would use in Iraq and subsequently Afghanistan. So very open-minded about outside opinions. He doesn't care your rank or gender or you know, the degrees you have, but if you have a good idea, he's willing to listen.
That speaks to a great confidence, which I think no one who has followed his story even marginally would doubt. But it also speaks to a sort of humility at the same time.
I think so. He gets a reputation of being this ambitious general, but I think as I've gotten to know him, he's very humble to the core, and he always remembers his roots. You mentioned them earlier. He's from a small town just 7 miles from West Point. He grew up with very modest means. His father was a Dutch sea captain, and his country was invaded by the Nazis while he was at sea, and he was forced to land in New York and stayed there and sort of had to make a new life for himself, so not a lot of means to do that. And David Petraeus never forgets those roots, and I think it does keep him humble and modest, and he recognizes he had mentors that looked out for him and took his advice, if you will. And so I think he feels a bit of this pay it forward attitude. Mm-hmm. It's very inspirational for those who work around him, I think, as well.
Talk, Paula, about some of the people who were particularly influential in his early career.
Well, we tried to document in the book, and again, this first started as my dissertation.
The book does not read like a dissertation.
Thankfully,
that is a compliment.
Thankfully, it's not very pedantic. It's a very different style. But initially, I was writing my dissertation as an intellectual history to look at his role in galvanizing institutional change in the Army. And I explored the role of mentors and social networks. His experiences to include deployments to Haiti, to Bosnia, obviously Iraq, and so forth, and his education. So what was he reading while he was growing up? What was he discussing with these mentors? And what was he learning both at West Point, you know, in the military schools that we have to go through, and then at Princeton, which is a very challenging, intellectually challenging experience for him to be outside of his intellectual comfort zone or cocoon mm-hmm. that the military sort of provides for us. To bring it back to your question, that the key mentors that influenced his life were General Jack Galvin, and he met General Galvin while he was a lieutenant and then captain in at Fort Stewart in the 25th Infantry Division. And Galvin recognized his drive, his sort of intellectual capacity, and his soldiering acumen, if you will, and wanted to foster that and help him develop it. And Galvin is the one who encouraged him to go down the academic route, which is atypical for an infantry officer. And really, he could have been, Petraeus could have been sort of capped off at colonel because he chose this alternate route, but he had mentors like Galvin that were looking out for him. Another mentor was General Jack Keane, who's still very active in General Petraeus's life. General Keane met Petraeus when he was about a lieutenant colonel, and they worked together in the 101st Airborne Division. And fast forward to Iraq, General Keane was very instrumental in helping to design the implementation of the surge forces that President Bush supported in that war. And General Keane visited him several times in Afghanistan. In fact, I accompanied General Keane on one of his trips because I wanted to see how does he interact with David Petraeus now, and how is he influencing his thinking even as this battle is playing out. There are a number of other mentors. So we trace, you know, each of these mentors, about four key mentors in the book, and show how he was learning counterinsurgency or leadership techniques and styles. Many of these individuals are still active in his life today. It's fun to see them still interacting, actually.
Talk a little bit about the evolution of his interest in counterinsurgency, because the time in which he was entering the military as a student at West Point was a really key time in American history. We were at the tail end of the Vietnam War. A lot of things to be sort of mulled over and examined and understood what went right, a lot of which went wrong.
Well, he had been reading about counterinsurgency in Vietnam, and even as a cadet at West Point and after that. His mother was a librarian, and they did a lot of reading growing up. In fact, for him, that was a way to leave the borders of Cornwall, mm-hmm. New York. But when he had arrived at his first assignment in Vicenza, Italy, as a lieutenant, he already had this kind of fascination with counterinsurgency warfare. But it was when he met Galvin and at the next assignment and in their subsequent interactions that he really starts to look at what the future threat horizon looks like and how we should prepare to fight it. I had access to letters that Petraeus and Galvin exchanged over about three decades. And you can see the young Captain Petraeus writing to Galvin and saying, you know, we're not equipped to do this security force assistance mission, this counterinsurgency mission, and this is what I think we should do. And if you really want to make a change in the Army, you have to change the doctrine. He was saying this as a young captain, and you can see, you know, 20-some years later, he actually lives it and makes that change. I think the most formative experience for him in understanding counterinsurgency and insurgencies was when he went to visit Galvin as a captain. Petraeus was assigned to West Point in the Social Sciences Department and was teaching international security and economics. And during one of his summer breaks, Galvin invited him down to Southern Command, which was based in Panama at the time. And Galvin was the commander of the whole entire Southern Command region. And Petraeus arrives, and there are, you know, six countries with different types of small insurgencies going on. And he travels with Galvin to each of these countries, and he sees the violence. And he recalls one story where he stayed with the Mill Group commander in El Salvador. And when he arrived at the house, the Mill Group military group's commander's wife hands him a weapon and says, you know, she kind of says, "You're on your own. Here's your room, and you're on your own." And he, you know, the house is heavily guarded. Yeah. It's something young officers today, we don't know anything else because we've lived in this mm-hmm. type of warfare. But for him, it was, you know, peacetime army after Vietnam for quite a while. And so it was really eye-opening to him to see that these insurgencies are real. They're tough. They take sort of a comprehensive whole-of-government approach to solve them. And it's very difficult to create domestic will to support them. And it's really about winning the hearts and minds of the population. So some big lessons he learned from that experience. And he continued the dialogue with General Galvin after he left. He went Petraeus went back to West Point, continued teaching, and their letters, you know, you can see after he's had this experience, he's really thinking, okay, now we have to really prepare for that type of warfare, because it's unlikely that we'll have another large-scale war. Counterinsurgency is the threat in the horizon.
Paula Broadwell is my guest. She's research associate at the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University and author of the new book, All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. She's in town for World Affairs Council events tonight and tomorrow in Dallas and Fort Worth. You can find information at dfwworld.org and purchase tickets online. If you'd like to join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington is in with us now. Welcome back once again, Jeff.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. We are working on our second hour of Think today, and our goal, we're going to get a goal update here in just a minute, Chris, based on how things went in the first hour. But in this hour, in this break of Think, the first $350 that's contributed, and any various amounts, all added up to $350, will be matched dollar for dollar by Amy Titus, who's been contributing some matching grants during Think Today. So if you want to make your contribution, and this is at any amount, the first $350 that's contributed during this break will be matched dollar for dollar. So call 888-694-6931 or go to kera.org and make your contribution. You can get your very own copy of Paula Broadwell's book, All In, The Education of General David Petraeus, when you join the station with a contribution of $120.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating portrait of one of the most fascinating figures of really contemporary American military history. It's a book that lots of people are talking about. It is on the New York Times bestseller list, and we are pleased to be able to offer it to you. If that will push you over into the side of making a contribution to the station, at or above the $120 level is what we are asking. And you can do this by going online to kera.org or calling 1-888-694-6931. By 2 o'clock today, Jeff, we are looking for $7,546 worth of contributions in order to stay on track.
And that's really doable, Chris. That means that in the last hour, Think listeners and KERA contributors contributed about $6,454 in the last hour. So we're on track. We're virtually on track. We're almost there. Your call right now to 888-694-6931. Your online contribution at KERA.org will help us, knock this down and achieve this goal during Think Today to stay on track to finish the drive tomorrow. Remember, when we started this drive a week ago or 2 weeks ago, our promise was that we were going to do everything possible to do this drive in half the time. So instead of the 24 days that it took last January, and as I've said many times, the Egyptian revolution was more efficient and faster than the KERA membership drive last January, because it took us 24 days. But we still brought you all that news during that time. But it took 24 days, which is a little outrageous. You asked for a shorter drive. We're doing everything we possibly can to encourage you to make your contribution now. But really, it's up to you. Your call right now, your online contribution right now, will help us get there and help us wrap this drive up by 7 o'clock tomorrow evening.
There are people listening right now, perhaps you are among them, who will, between now and 7 o'clock tomorrow, make a contribution. Why not make it now? Why wait? Why let it hang over you and have it, making you feel bad throughout the rest of the day? You know you value public radio. It's one of those resources that if you rely on it, it makes sense to understand that we rely on you as well. We can only provide this programming with the support of listeners, who, people just like you, give us more than half the funding required to put all this programming on the air, including shows like Think, like Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Your support makes it possible. Please go online to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931.
And do it right now, because the first $350 that's contributed during this break will be matched dollar for dollar by Amy Titus. So if you call and make a $120 contribution right now, and you're within the first $350, Amy's going to match your contribution dollar for dollar, and you can get your very own copy of All In by our guest Paula Broadwell.
Such a deal.
Please don't wait. You can do it online as well. Go to kera.org, click and join there, but please do it now.
Back in 2 minutes with Paula Broadwell.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paula Broadwell. She's research associate at the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard and author of the new book All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. She is in town for World Affairs Council events tonight and tomorrow. You can find information about those and perhaps purchase tickets at dfwworld.org. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, ask a question, make a comment, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. Where we now have lines open, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So how directly involved was General Petraeus, then General Petraeus, in the creation of that field manual? Because as you mentioned, there were other people who were on the team, but to what extent was he sort of editing every line and going through all that content?
Chris, he brought on two key players, one a lieutenant colonel, John Noggle, who was also a PhD.
Had him on the show a few years ago.
Yes, and he's a counterinsurgency expert and now is the president of the Center for New American Security. He actually just stepped down from that president position to teach at the U.S. Naval Academy, but he's teaching counterinsurgency, so he's predictable. The other individual is one of General Petraeus' classmates from West Point, and his name is Dr. Conrad Crane. He's out of uniform right now, but he's at the Army War College, and he was another counterinsurgency expert, but a military historian to the core. So Petraeus invited these two to spearhead the effort to help him build a team, but he was very involved in building that team. He brought in old friends like Elliot Cohen. Petraeus reached out to folks that he had met when he was in Central America in the 80s, who were called Lickamites instead of Coindinistas. So they're low-intensity conflict sort of aficionados, if you will, and they believed in the concept and the doctrine. So he reached out to some of these older generations who had done counterinsurgency for real before. And the team that was brought together met over a very short period of time, and they had a three-day conference, brought all these folks in, and wrote like mad. They sent the field manual out, but not before Petraeus had a chance to edit it. And he kept very close oversight. In fact, he edited the first chapter 30 times. And I was able to retrieve some of those edits he wrote in the margins and so forth. I felt for military history, it would be very interesting to see what was his actual input there. But he was very engaged in the whole process. I actually got the archives of all the emails were sent during that time, so you could see him conducting the shaping operation and responding to antagonists like Ralph Peters, who felt like the manual was poorly it was not fully historically based, that it wasn't applicable to Iraq and so forth, and he tried to address all of those kind of concerns, if you will. And it's, I didn't show all of that in the book. The book is nearly 400 pages, and a lot of it ended up on the cutting room floor, but that will be in my dissertation. So once I finish it, I have to go back to that. In any case, he was very involved, and I think this wasn't his first writing endeavor. Obviously, he'd been a professor; he loved to write. In fact, he is one of the reasons I think he's so happy at the agency. Is he's much more of a he's a brains and bronze guy, but I really think he likes using his brains and the intellectual side of creating doctrine and so forth. So he had managed a very successful counterinsurgency campaign in Iraq, but that wasn't the first time he had seen it. As we discussed, he was in Central America, and he had been thinking about some of these concepts of nation building in other tours in Haiti when he was a lieutenant colonel. He was working with the government there on a UN mission to stand up the Haitian government and help security forces defend themselves. When he was in Bosnia, he was working ostensibly on another sort of counterinsurgency or nation-building effort when they were tracking war criminals, and then that mission turned to a counterterrorism one after 9/11. So a lot of these concepts of engaging the population and working on governance and development were not new to him. And the counterinsurgency field manual gave him the opportunity really to write it all down, to bring his personal experience, and then to bring in these historians who had studied many counterinsurgencies in the past, both successful and unsuccessful counterinsurgency efforts, and infuse all of that into this one manual. Now, the manual is not perfect. It was published commercially, which is very unusual for an Army field manual, as you know. And it was downloaded from the internet, I think, 1.5 million times. So, it was looked at as sort of a holy grail for how can we do better in Iraq? How can we win? If you remember during that time, the violence was escalating. Mm-hmm. U.S. casualties were tremendous. They were horrific. Not long after he got there, I think the peak was 120 soldiers killed per month. in the month of May, I should say.
And that's U.S. soldiers.
U.S. soldiers, that's right. I mean, you know, hundreds, thousands more Iraqis were dying. And so everyone, I think, in the nation was looking for something, some hope that we could turn the situation around. But as I said earlier, they turned around that field manual in a very quick time. And there's some discussion now by antagonists who feel like it's not applicable to Afghanistan. It's not a sort of comprehensive counterinsurgency doctrine that we can continue to use. And Petraeus would agree, you know, you have to adapt this manual and our approaches in counterinsurgency to the local environment. And so there are some revisions going on right now. But I think to bring it back to your question again, he was very involved. He remains very interested in it now. And in fact, he was recently in Central America in his new capacity as the director of the CIA and meeting with Colombians who are fighting a massive counterinsurgency down there. And several senior leaders brought the field manual and wanted his autograph. So the legend lives on elsewhere. And I think many of the principles in that doctrine are still many of the principles in that manual are still very applicable and are still relevant today.
Among the primary concerns about applying something like counterinsurgency to these conflicts that we've been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan is the amount of time and the amount of money it takes, and certainly the amount of resources with regard to soldiers. And this is a fight he fought multiple times over the past several years.
Yeah, in the 1980s, he co-authored a article with General Galvin called Uncomfortable Wars, and it talked about how exactly the variables you've just mentioned make these wars so difficult. They're very long, they're protracted, they take a lot of domestic patience, they're very expensive. As you can see now, I think the cost of one soldier's year in Afghanistan is $1 million. Mm. We have problems at home that we could be spending that money on, so you can see why there's not a lot of domestic support for when we're not showing the greatest progress there. And we should come back to Afghanistan later. But he fully understands those kind of constraints and the fact that winning is such a nebulous term. But when the alternative is allowing this nation, Afghanistan, for example, to become a safe haven for terrorists again, I think these military leaders who recognize that threat is very realistic are willing to stick it out and fight for the long term. But, you know, they also recognize the constraints and the cost in blood and treasure. So the idea is to get the host nation to be able to defend themselves. And that's what we did in Iraq. We stood up an Iraq military. We helped with governance and development. So local governance and federal governance could bloom again, if you will. And thankfully in Iraq, they already had that kind of existing infrastructure. It's much more difficult in Afghanistan. They've never had a real functioning government, never had a centralized government for sure, but at the local level, governance is basically non-existent as well. So it takes an even longer period of time. But in Afghanistan, we've also been working to stand up the Afghan National Security Forces, and that is our ticket out. And that is part of the counterinsurgency strategy that he's sort of subscribed to and promotes. Again, it's a slow process.
Let me interrupt you, because Petraeus doesn't want the ticket out to leave quite as soon as the Obama administration does.
No, I think, obviously he's still interested in Afghanistan. The agency has representation in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But I think it would be wrong to say there's daylight between the president or the White House and Director Petraeus. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's daylight between the president and General Allen, who's the new commander in Afghanistan right now, either. In fact, I spoke with General Allen yesterday to ask about some of these points. The Secretary of Defense, Panetta, made a statement yesterday about leaving early, and it was, I think, a slip of tongue, and it will be clarified today. But, the president has a point about withdrawing by 2014. This can't go on forever. We should have started this train and equip program to give Afghans the security capacity, you know, as far as just plain old security and defense, you know, working on governance and development and rule of law. Those are efforts that take a generation to really make a difference. But for them to defend themselves, that's the minimum we need to leave there and not have Afghanistan become a safe haven again. So he works with the president pretty closely now. They're in close correspondence while he's the director of the CIA. And the president and he and General Allen and I think all senior military leaders recognize what is at risk and what the costs are, and are in line with this withdrawal, this transition to happen by 2014. But they all agree that there will be some overwatch, that will have a security force assistance mission there to make sure that Afghans are able to sustain the gains that we've made collectively.
Talk a little bit about the assignment of then-General Petraeus to take over command in Afghanistan. He had been running CENTCOM, technically it was a demotion to then take over in Afghanistan and be on the ground there. Talk about why he accepted that assignment.
Well, we begin the book in the first chapter with his drive to the White House, just after General McChrystal has left the White House and the Rolling Stone article had broke. And basically exposed McChrystal, and it was likely that he was going to lose his job. But Petraeus is on the way to the White House thinking to himself that he hopes his friend McChrystal keeps his job because we've just started to gain new momentum in Afghanistan at that point. And but he knows in the back of his mind that his name is probably in the hat for a replacement if McChrystal has to go. In fact, he received a call from Admiral Mullen the night before saying there's some discussion that you may be, you know, selected because you were at CENTCOM. You know the theater. You are a proven combat commander. Look what you achieved in Iraq. So heads up, your name is in the hat. That was not being speculated about in the news. I don't know if you remember that period, but when the news reel was kind of spinning about who could potentially replace McChrystal, Petraeus's name was not in there. So I personally didn't think he would be selected, but he met with the president. The president asked him to serve. He didn't skip a beat. He didn't set any preconditions. He didn't ask for more troops or more time. He didn't say yes, but guarantee that I'll get chairman position afterwards. He just saluted and said it would be an honor to serve. And, you know, I think that's, he takes pride in that sort of salute and carry on approach that he takes to dealing with the president.
Because he did for a time want to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Well, he's a competitive individual and he's very driven and he wants to be the best at whatever he's doing. And if you look at his track record, his report cards, if you will, at every one of his assignments, he has always been the number one officer in whatever the position was. And so, of course, he would aim for the highest position. But he had some reservations about the chairman job, even while he was in Afghanistan, because knowing where the military is moving with the state of the economy, with this aversion to large-scale boots-on-the-ground warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a looming drawdown of those forces because personnel costs are the most expensive and we'll be cutting back and intervening in different ways, he recognized that maybe that wasn't the best position for him, even though it was, you know, quote-unquote, the highest-ranking military position. He had been thinking about the CIA for some time. So when Secretary Gates came to visit him in Kabul in November 2010, he told Petraeus, I have some unfortunate news to share with you. You are not even being considered for chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And Petraeus was really stung by it, just the fact that he had, as you said, accepted a demotion, saluted when the president asked him to serve, you know, after having turned the tide in the war in Iraq and you know, they hadn't really achieved that much progress by the fall of 2010. But in hindsight now, the surge of forces that went there really, really was. And so Gates was telling him, you know, what you're doing here is unprecedented. We don't want to talk about it because we want to underpromise and overdeliver. But, you know, we still have this bad news for you. So it was, you know, quite a sting to him personally. You can imagine if you're in his position. But
let me jump in here and we will continue this thought because I think it's a really interesting thread and I want to make sure we have adequate time to cover it. My guest is Paula Broadwell, Research Associate at the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard and author of the new book, All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. We'll come back to our talk with Paula in a few minutes. If you've got a question to ask, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org. I'm joined once again here in the studio by Jeff Whittington, Senior Producer of Think. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. We are working on a goal this hour of it was about $7,500 for this hour. I think we'll have an update for you here shortly. Right now, it's important that you know we have a speed match during this break right now. The first $400 worth of contributions will be matched dollar for dollar by Amy Titus. This is our last speed match of the show today. And you know what, Chris? If today does turn out to be what I've been calling the potentially penultimate day.
Potentially penultimate.
The potentially proverbial penultimate day of the drive. This could be the last hour that you, our favorite listeners, have a chance to support the Think Show during the drive. So please don't wait. Please call right now, 888-694-6931, or contribute at kera.org. The first $400 in contributions will be matched dollar for dollar that come in during this break.
We would love to be able to thank you for a contribution of $120 or more with your very own copy of Paula Broadwell's new book, All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. Really interesting piece of work. We know, based on listenership, that many of you will be interested in the subject. Mm-hmm. If you are ready to read the book and also ready to make a contribution of support to KERA, why not do it now? Make that gift. Qualify in the first few minutes for this speed challenge from Amy Titus. And so many good things will happen based on you picking up the phone at 1-888-694-6931 or going online to kera.org.
So the goal update, $6,166 left to raise by 2 o'clock. We have about 22 minutes to do it. Your call right now to 888-694-6931. Your online contribution at kera.org will get us there. I want to thank Bhaskar Banerjee and Sunitha Venkataraman in Dallas, Michael Dooley in Dallas, Nessie Jimenez in North Richland Hills, Stacey Mankoff in Dallas, and William Turnage in Hearst. We also heard from Aaron Bowen and Julie Anderson in Grapevine, Jim and Jan Gaston from Keller, and Amber Sims from Mesquite. Thank you so much to each of you. You're the reason that KERA is possible and the reason that KERA continues to exist.
Thank you also, Charles Williams in Dallas, Allison and Charles Getz in Dallas, Sanjay Sinha in Allen, James and Laura Noel in Dallas. Thank you, Therese Palmer in Rockwall, Ilam Seal in Plano. Thank you, Nancy Hartley in Dallas. And thank you, Holly and Brian Ware in Double Oak. Double Oak, what an awesome name.
Double Oak. It's good to hear from Double Oak. 888-694-6931. Online at kera.org. Again, our goal for the hour, just $6,166 left to raise. KERA listeners have contributed nearly $40,000 today. I think about $37,000. Maybe we can get an update. I can go pull an update on where we are on the overall goal. But I know we're getting closer and closer to, and we may already be close to the $200,000 left to raise in the drive. Our goal is to wrap it up by tomorrow at 7. And we hope that you'll contribute right now with a phone call to 888-694-6931 or an online contribution at kera.org.
You are able to count on KERA every single time you turn on your radio and tune it in to 90.1. This station is here for you, the station that provides you local programming, local coverage with our award-winning team of journalists. We also have regional programming from Texas, and we have national and international programming. NPR has one of the largest journalism staffs deployed around the world today of any major news organization. Your contribution makes it possible for us to bring all of this to you 24 hours of every single day. You get to hear your money at work when you make a contribution, and you get to hear it immediately. You're hearing it now at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
So far today, $40,382 has been contributed. We've got about a day and a half left, $204,000 left to raise. If we can make the goal for this hour, I think we'll be under $200,000. So please don't wait. Please call now or click and join at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paula Broadwell, author of the new book All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. She's in town for World Affairs Council events tonight and tomorrow. You can find information about those at dfwworld.org. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think at kera.org. So when we left off, we were talking about Admiral Mullen saying, telling General Petraeus that he was not a candidate for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
That's right, Chris. And again, Petraeus felt, sort of an affront. He felt like it stung, like he was a little disappointed he wasn't even being considered. But again, he had some mixed feelings about that job in the chairman position. And he didn't miss a beat with Gates. He said, okay, I'd like to suggest CIA director. And it was something he'd been thinking about for some time. And Gates was intrigued by the idea. Secretary Gates had been the director of the CIA himself, and he knew Petraeus well. He knew Petraeus as a consumer of intelligence. He saw how, as an operational commander, he had driven intelligence and, driven this community to provide for these two war theaters and help to kind of shape their operations, demand and supply. Mm-hmm. He felt like he, with his organizational leadership abilities, would be a great position for that person for that position. So Secretary Gates took their recommendation back to the president, but the president and Petraeus did not speak about it until March. And when Petraeus was back for testimony in March, he was invited to the White House, and they sat down together, and the president basically said, I'm considering you for this position. I think you'd be perfect at it. You're a warfighter. You know the theater. You have a network you understand the intelligence community, but I'd like you to take off the uniform.
Yeah.
And he said, I understand why you'd like me to take off the uniform, and I'd be honored to take the job. I'm paraphrasing, of course, mm-hmm. but and then he was nominated a month later and returned for the announcement in Washington, D.C. And I think, you know, at the end of the book, we sort of show how Petraeus struggles a little bit with having to take off the uniform and leave this identity, if you will. And as a military officer myself who left active duty, mm-hmm. I can relate to that. Even as a young captain, I felt like everything I'd grown up knowing and doing and acting and believing and upholding was suddenly being taken away from me. Well, it's not. Those ideals stay with you. Just because you don't have the uniform on, you know, you're still the military leader that you are. And he recognized that quickly. But he went through this process of kind of he's a very self-actualized leader, but he recognized he was frustrated about having to leave Afghanistan early. He wanted to stay through the fighting season and make sure those gains were held, that his men had fought so hard to clear different areas. You know, he wasn't sure how he would be received at the agency. I think he was confident about it and very excited about the position, but there was a lot of speculation that he was coming in as an outsider and how would they feel about him? You know, would he try to militarize the CIA and so forth?
There's that tension between the civilian leadership and the military leadership historically in this country.
Right, but I think it's a healthy tension. And even with the drawdown debate, there was tension amongst the senior national security staff. But that's good. You know, you want individuals to play devil's advocate, and you want them to bring their personal perspective, their professional perspective, and challenge each other so that, you know, so there's not groupthink going on. So it's more infotopia, if you will, to pull an academic term. But he, you know, fast forward to his time at the agency, he loves it. He doesn't want to leave there. I think he'd be happy there for another 8 years. And he's made the transition very well. And I get that from some of my former intelligence colleagues. I was in the intel field in the Army, and some of my colleagues transferred over and work there now. And I hear very positive things about what he's doing and the energy he's brought to the organization. So I think it went smoother than anyone imagined.
There have been rumblings over time about the White House being concerned that General Petraeus might consider a run for the presidency. He has said absolutely not. Why absolutely not?
Well, his... on record, he says that he is not interested in politics. He's interested in serving and being a warfighter, and yet another reason for him to be at the agency rather than in a sort of administrative type job, if you will. He also says that if he was to run for office, he would have to yield on his principles to appeal to the left or right, that he, you know, to win the primaries. And he's just not willing to do that. Personally, I think he's got electability from either party, and he would not have to yield. I mean, he's an American hero, you know, with his faults for sure, but he's a tremendous leader. He's proven himself in leadership and in foreign policy and economic development and many different fields, you know, atypical for a military officer, but he's been able to serve in those soldier, scholar, diplomatic type roles. I don't think his wife really supports it. That's another reason. She's obviously sacrificed a lot while mm-hmm. he's been abroad, and his kids have too, and their family is wonderful, and everybody, it's amazing how great their kids turned out. It really is a salute to Holly Petraeus, his wife, for being Mrs. Dad, if you will, while he was gone for nearly 8 years since 9/11. And no, I think he enjoys serving in this capacity, and he realizes he'll probably hopefully have other opportunities, so why run for office?
State Department, do you think?
Well, it's not an elected position, obviously. Excuse me. But again, he's very happy at the agency, and he's said to many of his friends who are also friends of mine that it's the best job ever. He could never have imagined having so much passion for this field that he's never known, you know, this new sort of world, if you will. And I think when he first got there and just learned more about the capabilities, obviously he's very aware of what the agency's capabilities were. But when you're the director, you have full knowledge. Mm-hmm. And he's very excited about the workforce, about the intellectual capital there, about the great things they're doing overseas and so forth. And as you look at how we're shifting from, again, large-scale boots on the ground and major operations and interventions with the military to more covert operations such as the drones, which he, you know, the agency doesn't admit that they have, but you can understand why he feels this is a great place for him to be. And at the end of the day, Chris, what he likes is being consequential and contributing to national security. There's a motto we all learned at the military academy: duty, honor, country. And I feel like he really believes that. In fact, you know, he's put his duty, honor, and country above his family to serve. And I think he continues to do that there. So whether it's at the agency or if he eventually is selected for State Department or maybe somewhere down the line, Secretary of Defense, he'll be capable of serving in those roles. But he's very happy with where he's at right now.
Talk a little bit about the process that you went through to interview him multiple occasions. My understanding is often literally on the road, sneakers strapped on, and also observation and how that played into what you learned. And finally, how you shift from having someone who is in a mentoring role to really studying and analyzing the work that he's done and the successes and failures he's had throughout the course of his career.
Well, our real, I think, rapport began on our first run together. And I had proposed bringing along a recorder, and I would interview and record while we ran. But he didn't know, or I didn't think he knew, that I had graduated in the top of my class physically mm-hmm. In fitness rankings at West Point and was on the cross country and indoor and outdoor track team and loved to run and was a little bit of a rabbit. And I knew he was too. So I thought, all right, I'm going to challenge this guy. And he was thinking the same thing. All right, I'm going to challenge this smarty pants who thinks she can give me a run for the money. So we started at the Pentagon and we ran 3-4 miles at a pretty decent clip. But then he started to pick it up. And this is one of his techniques. He runs with his subordinates all the time and anyone who'll challenge him. It's a confidence building thing. It's a test. Mm-hmm. he's often used it to interview aides because if they can't keep up with him on a run, then that's something that's very important to him, physical fitness. It's his outlet. That's when he does his thinking when he's out running for an hour. So he needs somebody who can kind of keep up in that realm. So he picked up the pace and I picked up the pace and we stopped talking. I turned off the recorder and the last few miles we stopped interviewing, obviously. but it was, I think I earned some rapport with him because I could stick with him and it became a mechanism for us to train together for him, obviously a very busy man. It was a way to multitask, if you will. Mm-hmm. And when I started going to Kabul to embed there, we would do runs in the morning or the weekends whenever he was running with his security team, I would join. And we're running, 17 circles around the embassy compound. It's pretty boring. Mm-hmm. But when you're interviewing, it makes it go a little bit faster. Yeah. So it was fun. It was, I think, for him a bit of a distraction from the war. He's a strong guy. He's a tough guy. He's a talented guy. But at the end of the day, he's a human. And war sucks. And it's tough. And it's horrible. And he had to deal with, letters from grieving parents and spouses. And he kept those letters in a drawer in his desk and would read them. And he wrote personal letters back to any parent or spouse or sibling or whoever wrote, on behalf of the fallen soldier, and took those losses very personally. And, I try to portray in the book the sort of burden of command and how difficult it is for these commanders to compartmentalize that and always be the source of strength and hope and inspiration. But at the end of the day, they're human and it's tough on them too. So, I enjoyed being a bit of an outlet for him and running was a way to, distract him, I think, from those daily strains and stresses of just incredible pressure, the timelines, that kind of ticking clocks from 49 other countries, the pressure from America, not a lot of domestic support. So again, physical fitness kind of became a foundation of our friendship and then this whole interview process. You asked also how he's switched from the role of mentor to how do you study your mentor, maybe is what
you're
asking.
Yeah, how do you write objectively about your mentor?
Yes. Well, I guess he didn't really become a very close mentor until I had spent about 8 months in Afghanistan, not solid, but I'd go 3 weeks at a time and then I'd come back to the States for mm-hmm. 3 weeks and back and forth. It was wonderful for my family. It was very challenging, actually. But I think on one of my trips in the spring, I sent him an email. I was on the border of Pakistan with General Campbell, who was the 101st Airborne Division commander at the time. And we had been visiting one of the combat outposts there. And I sent an email to Petraeus. Every once in a while, I'd check in because I was off kind of having this adventure. And, he was just wanting to make sure I was okay, so I promised to check in. And I said, "We are having a blast. We just got shot at. This is awesome." And, my husband says I have a strange sense of adventure. But I think what Petraeus took from that was she's out there sharing risk and hardship with the troopers, trying to get the story, trying to get the scoop. And let's help her to make sure she gets the story right, as far as the embedding with the tactical units and then also spending time at headquarters. And
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. And okay. I'm so sorry to cut you off mid-story, but people will find lots of great information in the book. It is called All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. Paula Broadwell will be speaking to World Affairs Council events in Dallas and Fort Worth tonight and tomorrow. Learn more at dfwworld.org. Paula, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Thanks to all of you who are listening this hour, all of you who have joined the station as supporting members. We greatly appreciate that. We have $4,940 left to raise. You can help us right now. Your contribution is instrumental in ensuring that this station has the resources it needs to take care of you every day with the kind of programming that you have come to expect from us. You have less than 5 minutes to help us reach this goal. We know that you will step up to the plate now, and we greatly appreciate your help. You can do this at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Chris Boyd. She's Chris Boyd. I'm Jeff Whittington. $4,940 left to go in the next 5.5 minutes. Call 888-694-6931. Go online to KERA.org like Linda Vu and Garland did, like Arnessa Garrett in Dallas did, like Brian Kleppel and Tyler and Diane Moore in Dallas and Penelope Bisbee in Dallas and Richard Gilligan in Dallas and Mark Trimble and Amy Sada in Carrollton and Betty Knight in Arlington. Those folks all did their part. They either clicked and joined at KERA.org or they called 1-888-694-6931. If the drive-in's tomorrow, this is your last chance to support Think during the membership campaign. And what a great time for you to do it with just $4,730 left to raise to make our goal this hour.
Thank you so much, Sherry Dunn in Irving. Thank you, Jennifer Davis in Keller, Laura Adair in Frisco. Thanks so much, Kay Merkel Boroff in Dallas, Carol Dudley in Flower Mound. Thank you, Marilyn Halpin in Dallas. And thank you, Remington Pohlmeyer in Denton. Your support and your support, if you are getting ready to make your contribution now, really does matter. $4,730 left to go in the next few minutes in order to make the goal. We know that you like listening to Think. We know that this is part of your day, part of your media diet. Maybe you are hearing this on the podcast. Your contribution at KERA.org helps to pay the costs to put this show on the air and all the others that you count on, produced locally and also produced around the country and around the world for you. So please make your contribution at 1-888-694-6931. Perhaps choose a copy of Paula Broadwell's new book about General David Petraeus, All In.
KERA helps you stay informed. KERA is important to you. Well, your help is important to the station. Won't you help KERA reach the goal? Won't you help your fellow listeners make this public radio station continue to be a success and a successful reality here in North Texas and on the web, where you know many thousands, many, many thousands of you listen all over the country, all over the world, listen to KERA. We received a contribution from Vietnam the other day from someone who listens quite regularly and quite in a dedicated way to KERA overseas. Well, if you do that, then it's worth your support. And you're right here in North Texas. Chances are that you've been listening for years, and all we're asking you to do is help the station. Just help the station make this goal. Help the station be successful in this membership campaign. Just $4,730 left to raise. You've got about 3 minutes to help us reach that goal.
Quality radio is not free. It may feel free because it comes to you over the airwaves or easily and without a per-unit cost when you find us online. But in fact, there are significant costs associated with putting this station on the air, putting on these programs. A lot of local stations do not have shows like Think that are locally produced that bring to you best-selling authors and people who are well-known in their fields. We are very fortunate to be able to provide this service, and it is all because of you. Your contribution in any amount at KERA.org makes it happen. We all, you know, no one is standing over you watching as you write out a check or pull out your credit or debit card and make that contribution. And yet if somebody were, if you were standing in a room full of other people and those names we just read were all around you, you wouldn't hesitate to make your contribution. Do the right thing even though no one is watching and go online to KERA.org now or call 1-888-694-6931. This would be a terrific time to hear from someone at the Friends level of membership, Jeff.
Yeah, it would be $4,730 left to raise here in about a minute and 40 seconds. And a couple of folks at the $1,500 Friends level would reduce that really quickly. to about $1,730 left to raise. Hey, we can make this goal even if you contribute just $100 for your annual listening. That's about what people give on average anyway, between $100 and $120 per year. If you would just make that call right now or make that online contribution and help the station make this goal, we could wrap this membership campaign up. We have about 28 hours left to our deadline, and the deadline of 7 o'clock tomorrow evening to wrap this drive up successfully. Still about $202,000 left to raise to do it. So your contribution right now is more important than ever. We can get there, but only if you will join in.
Consider this: if you listen to the station, if you love the station, if you count on the station, love KERA, but have never made a contribution, we would not be here today or any other day if everybody else did the same thing you did, if everybody else chose not to take action. Those of you who do take action are responsible for the presence of KERA in this community, the presence of public radio in North Texas. We have $4,730 left to raise to reach our goal for Think Today of $14,000. Won't you please take action right now for the station that contributes so much to your life? I would argue much more than the value of the dollars that you might send to us now. Online at KERA.org or 1-888-694-6931. Thank you so much for your support of Think and of KERA.